Live from Jeerber, this is the Locktoon Podcast. I'm Amy.
I'm Mel.
We're rereading Harrow the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. Today we're covering chapters 47 through 49. These chapters are packed with such good shit. The River Bubble crew, with Harrow now back in possession of her pre-Lictorhood memories, fights the Sleeper in an incredibly epic battle that literally makes me cry every time. And sandwiched in the middle of this epic battle, Gideon Nav basically spends a couple pages insulting Ianthe, which is great. It's great to experience.
These are the chapters we all need. Amy, before we jump into it, I have to tell you, I got this really exciting call, and Hamilton Beach wants to sponsor us.
Oh?
Do you know why?
Why?
Because they make griddles.
Oh my God!
You told me, make a griddle joke every episode. Hot new something-something on the griddle every single episode from here on out.
Wow.
But Amy, don't despair. I have another joke for you.
Okay.
Cam and Gideon walk into a bar.
Oh, dear.
Who serves them drinks?
Who?
Teacher. Because he has all the spirits.
Oh, my God. Nice. Two in a row, baby.
You know, as we get closer to Nona, I got to amp up my joke game.
Yeah. I have to say that I forgot what Hamilton Beach was, but I'm glad that I now remember that it is an appliance brand.
I did Google like top griddle on the market so I could pick a brand that I thought maybe people would know.
Wirecutter.com?
Yeah. Just so you know, the Hamilton Beach griddles are top rated.
Yeah, we are actually sponsored by Hamilton Beach. Oh my God. All right. Well, we only have three chapters to cover today, but they're pretty beefy and they're very gay. And, you know, every time there are some gay chapters, we've got to spend some extra time, give them some extra love. So, chapter 47, we got a fractured fifth house skull. We're in the third person river bubble. And this is basically the first half of the fight against the Sleeper. So, in our last episode, we left off with Abigail says to the River Bubble crew that they're going to exorcise the Sleeper, and that's where we left off. So now we're with the whole crew. I gotta say, this whole bit with all of them together brings me so much joy. Their interactions are perfect. I think this is some of the most perfectly written material in these books. I don't know what it is about this last... I know that we love the Gideon bits and all of that, but for me, especially chapter 49... I cannot handle it. So
I knew this was going to happen. 49 is actually one of my least favorite chapters.
Are you serious?
But I'm really excited to talk to you about it because I knew it was going to be one that you loved.
But this is why we work well together, Mel.
You know, we balance each other out.
Mm-hmm.
In chapter 47, when they're starting to do the exorcism, it really gives me that light as a feather, stiff as a board vibes. Did you do that when you were a kid?
I didn't, but I've seen it in shows.
I don't know, in sixth grade, you'd have all your friends over, and one of them would, like, lie on the floor, totally rigid, with their eyes closed, and everyone was supposed to put a pinky under them, and then chant, light as a feather, stiff as a board, and raise them up. And I don't know, for some reason, this chapter just gives me those vibes. Obviously, it's much more serious. A lot is on the line here, but...
But it gives you middle school vibes.
I got middle school vibes, for sure.
All right, well, that's fair. I will say that 47 is the build-up to my favorite, 49. So everyone is gathering around. They're painting wards on themselves. They're laying out candles and doing all the things they need to do to set up this exorcism. We see one final wake note. You want to read it, since it's traditional for you to read these notes?
Yeah. End of the line. Falling. Oxygen. Can't last the distance and won't redirect power from the payload. Instead, I will make you watch. Instead, I will make... Instead, I will make you watch every moment as I get the last privilege you cannot enjoy, you bygone son of a bitch.
Incredibly well acted.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm working on my voice acting career. Oh, and then, sorry, it ends with, I hope you're both as sorry as I am.
Oh, right, right.
Mm-hmm. And the you bygone son of a bitch, I think that's referring to Gideon the First. Mm-hmm. And then, I hope you're both as sorry as I am. Is that both Pyrrha and Gideon, or is that Augustine and Mercy?
I think it's Pyrrha and Gideon. That was my read. It does make me wonder, obviously this note didn't actually reach Gideon, but I wonder if Gideon knows about Pyrrha. Do we ever know that? If he knows that they compartmentalized? I think he doesn't.
Gideon doesn't know. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's our last Wake note. And obviously what this is when Wake was falling onto the ninth house with baby Gideon Nav in this little container, she gave all of the leftover energy in her power suit to baby Gideon instead of using it for herself. And so she died. So she basically sacrificed herself for Gideon, but because it was her last ditch effort to break into the tomb, which I can't imagine she really knew that much about, but enough that she was willing to sacrifice herself.
Right. Yeah, I think a little bit later on, and we'll talk about this in the next episode, Wake wasn't privy to the whole way in which this blood ward worked, but she knew it was an important piece. So I think it's interesting that she does sacrifice herself. Anyway, we can talk about Wake maybe at the end of chapter 49, but I kind of wonder if she knew she was going to become a revenant.
Yeah, maybe. I do think it's ironic that she hates necromancy so much and then fully takes advantage of it.
Totally. Well, what else is she going to do?
When your towers are falling around you, you don't become a hero. So,
as they say.
But it did pay dividends, you know? At the end of the day, by sacrificing herself, that is what is eventually going to open up the tomb. But Harrow and Ordis have a little conversation, and Ordis says that he thinks Harrow was never mad, never insane. And I feel like I agree, but obviously she was hallucinating or having these psychotic episodes that were caused by something. And I was curious what your take on this was, what you think that she was experiencing. If she's not mad, then what was it?
Yeah. I interpret this in two ways. Mm-hmm. The first being that what I think Ordis is saying is that Harrow's experienced so much trauma in her life that who she is now and what she's been experiencing is a result of that trauma, and it wouldn't be appropriate to call it madness. Uh-huh. So that was one of the ways. I think another way that I look at this is that theme where we're not blaming the individual, we're blaming the system that they're part of. And it's like, of course Harrow is going through all of this shit. The world that she's been a part of is bananas. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unkind and it's cruel. And so I think that her body is coping with that system in the ways that it knows how. I also wonder about the hallucinations that are happening that aren't the body. Have there been references to other things that Harrow's seeing that isn't the body, or are these hallucinations specifically referring to the body?
Well, I think it says that she hears noises that aren't there, doors opening and closing, stuff like that, like little hallucinations.
Yeah, I think he's basically like, don't be so hard on yourself. You're not mad. You just have gone through a lot of shit.
Yeah.
And that's normal. You're not normal. What you're experiencing makes a lot of sense.
Right.
I come to really like Ordis in these last chapters, which is nice. I feel like he really develops as a character a little bit more.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying about these last chapters. This last confrontation in the river bubble is that get a little taste of Dulcinea, you get to know Ordis. Abigail comes together really beautifully as this absolutely perfect dream woman who I would marry in a moment if given the
you
chance.
You would?
I would. Mel, I feel like actually if you were to ask me who in these books I would actually date, like, you know, someone who actually has their shit together, it would obviously be Abigail.
Yeah, I would date Harrow for sure.
You would date Harrow? Wow, risky choice.
Harrow's kind of my type, and I will say no more about that.
You don't need to. I know. All right. So after her conversation with Ordis, Harrow talks with Dulcie, And there's this very funny bit. Basically, Harrow's like, Dulcinea, why are you here? You don't owe me anything. And Dulcinea says that she was held back her whole life because she was always afraid that she was going to die. But now she's dead and she has nothing left to fear. And she is, the quote is, I'm sick of roses and I am horny for revenge.
Yeah, I mean, through that conversation, we even learn a little bit about Protesilaus, mm-hmm. like how he has a whole family and he breeds flowers. And you're like, wow, this is so cute that this big, strong man breeds flowers. I just love that so much. Uh-huh. I'm so into that. But it's cool here because through this conversation with Dulcinea, we find out that everyone in the bubble can enforce some of their own rules. Because the reason why Dulcinea has been doing pretty well is because she wants to do well. Her body doesn't have to work as hard because she basically owns her own little space, and you can kind of manifest what you want in this bubble in some ways.
Yeah, and it's also that's why they get cold and get hungry and have to sleep and all of these, you know, normal human things that they've had to do in the bubble. It's they're enforcing their own rules. And Dulcinea also says that when Kithaerea boarded their shuttle and killed Protesilaus and started to ask her questions, Dulcinea told her a bunch of hot bullshit, hoping that someone would catch on when she got to Kanan House. It's weird to me still that Cam and Pal never noticed, especially Cam, but, you know, who knows? I guess they were both probably hurt that she wasn't really paying attention to them, and it sounds like it was a complicated situation for everyone.
Yeah, I actually had a question about the time. You remember way back, I feel like really early on in our podcasting journey.
Long ago.
We had a conversation about at what point Dulcinea was murdered by Kithaerea. We were like, was she murdered on the ship, or did she hold on to Dulcinea for a while and kill her in her rooms at Kanan House? And here it's kind of interesting because she doesn't confirm one way or another where she dies. She says Protesilaus died first, right, on the ship. She asked her a lot of questions. Dulcinea fed her a lot of hot bullshit. And then it seemed like she was really hoping Cam would figure something out. That makes it sound like to me that she was still alive in Kanan House, hoping that Cam would realize Kithaerea wasn't her. And then Kithaerea killed her.
The reason that I don't think that's true is because when they found the bone fragments in the incinerator, Ianthe has that great line where she's like, happy birthday. They must have died at the same time.
I don't think that was the line.
I think it is.
Happy birthday? Was that the line? Oh, that's so funny. I don't remember that.
Maybe it's not.
No, I mean, I
believe
you.
Bone nerds, please confirm. But there was something about them having died at the same time.
Okay. Huh. Interesting.
But I get where you're coming from.
Anyway, we can move on from Dulcinea.
There are these little vignettes with Harrow having these last moments with each person, which I think is cute. So this is the Harrow and Abigail moment. And Abigail's kind of asking Harrow about the signifiers around the sleeper. And the only thing that Harrow knows is that the two-handed sword that Judith saw is Gideon's. This also is the moment that confirms that the actual sword, like the sword minus Wake, is not really important. It sounds like it's just a standard issue infantry sword that Iglamine got from the Ninth House stock to give to Gideon. And what made it important or different is that Wake attached to it. I assume at some point when Gideon was around Wake's bones, so.
Interesting. I was wondering at what point Wake's revenant went to the two-hander, and I was wondering when Wake died, where her revenant attached to. If it just attached to her body, kind of like what Palamedes did, or if she attached herself to Gideon the baby.
I think at the very end of this book, it says, you know, where did you go? And she says, like, in my bones and then a sword.
Got it. Okay.
That is my Moira Quirk impression.
Oi.
Wow. Brutal crowd. But then the moment gets very cute because Harrow thanks Abigail. I mean, she has the same question, like, why are you here? And Abigail's like, I always like to get involved, and just responds with such sweetness and such grace. She says it takes a great deal of ego to be someone's psychopomp, and it's been my pleasure to be yours. And I just, I don't know what else to say except that she's just so wonderful. And it is such a joy that we get to, we could never have imagined in the first book that we would actually get to know this woman and come to love her so much. She's so great.
Sorry, y'all. You thought this was a Locke Tomb fan podcast. It's actually just an Abigail Pent fan podcast from here on out. We will only be talking about Abigail Pent.
The Penta cast?
Ooh, a Pent cast? Like
we'll workshop it. And then finally, Abigail asks Harrow if she knows what's in the tomb. And Harrow says yes. And Abigail says, God, I love tombs. And then, you know, moves on. I love that she's not nosy, but she is just so excitable and interested and invested.
Yeah. And after Harrow's little moment with Abigail, Harrow also has a little moment with Marta Dias, where essentially Harrow confirms for Marta that Judith is alive. And it's not like a cute moment per se between the two of them, but it is, I think, very satisfying to read, especially after reading As Yet Unsent, where you kind of understand the bond that Marta and Judith have. And when Harrow says to Marta, Judith is alive, Marta says, thought so, and then says, she'll give them hell.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the moment. And let me tell you, Judith really does give them hell. Judith does not go down easily, for sure.
Yeah, you got to have some respect for Judith. I mean, we'll see what she's like in Nona. She might be total shit, but, you know, I have some positive feels about Judith. She's a complicated character. And not everyone can be Abigail. Let's move on. Okay, so Harrow uncharacteristically is not grossed out by Magnus and Abigail kissing before they start this ritual.
Yeah, that's some growth.
Character growth.
Character growth, for sure.
And they all gather around, and Abigail sort of starts this chant. This is the moment we talked about long ago where Abigail says, I am Abigail for my mother's, Pent for my people, and... Abigail are her moms.
The note here is gay, 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 gay. I think that my note here was Polly, 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 which, you know, let's just smash them together. We got a lot going on here with Abigail for my mothers. We don't know how many mothers. I'm going to imagine 5.
All right. Yeah, I love it. I love to hear it. I am totally on board for that. So in the moment before Abigail attempts to exorcise the sleeper, she says to Harrow that she can tell that the sleeper is attached to something corporeal on the outside world, so the sword and or Kithareia. But
yeah, I think Kithareia.
So basically she can banish the haunting of Harrow, but she can't banish this foothold that the Revenant has in the real world. And so she continues with the ritual, and the coffin bursts open really dramatically, but there's nothing in there. And from a side corridor, the sleeper says, nice try.
Dun, dun, dun. It's like very cliche in the best way possible.
I know. I'm just saying, imagine this fight as an animated TV show.
Yeah.
It's really good. The choreography is incredible. Of course, I also zone out when I read just fight stuff, but I think that there's just enough little human moments and information in here that I am totally pulled in.
Yeah, same.
But we'll go quickly through the actual fight. It seems like the sleeper has inhuman power. This fight really reminds me of The Matrix, like there is no spoon.
Mm-hmm.
She's really able to make whatever she wants happen. She's creating the rules here.
The guns just keep appearing out of thin air. If she throws a gun, the guns appear right back in her hands. There are all sorts of different guns.
Exactly. I'm sure that she's very athletic and a very good fighter IRL. There's an incredible quote that says, the sleeper threw her has-suited body into a diving handspring, jackknifing feet first off the ground with a fluid agility that would have made even Camilla Hecht erupt in a wild, okay.
I love it. Okay. I feel like Moira Quirk is like, okay. Yeah.
So Protesilaus goes in first. He goes down pretty quickly. Magnus goes in. He goes down. Marta goes in. She goes down.
Yeah, the sleeper says basically, like, you can't hurt me. And she says to Harrow, if you give yourself up, the ghost can leave. If not, I end all of you. And it's really seeming like she is totally unstoppable. And she gets to the point where she says, yo, this is easy mode. Mm-hmm. There's no magic, which isn't totally true here. No tricks, which also is kind of a lie. And then none of your foul bullshit, which is also funny because all of it is necromancy.
Right.
But then she says, I've been doing this for years. The moment I want it to be over, it's all over. And I was wondering what you think if she's referring to she's been a revenant for years, so she knows her way around a bubble. What's Wake been up to for 20 years as a revenant? Does she have her own bubble with a weird romance novel in it or what? Or do you think that I've been doing this for years is just referring to her fighting the Nine Houses?
I thought it was the latter, that it's her fighting these wizards. But I think that probably what she's been doing is maintaining with like sheer willpower her hold on these corporeal objects with very little comprehension or ability to perceive. And that's why revenants don't last, right? Is because they go insane because nobody has that kind of willpower. But of all the people in these books, Wake would have that kind of willpower. And I think that makes for a better story, too, if Wake's just been kind of holding on with just this shred of understanding that what she has to do is kill these people. That's her whole goal, and that's allowed her to hang on, even though she hasn't been in a room with a romance novel.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of intense characters in this book, but Wake is, like, one of the most intense characters, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Finally, at the end of this chapter, the sleeper says, you guys can all go. I just want Harrow. And Harrow asks, what will happen if you take me? And the sleeper says, you'll die and I'll take your body and I'll finish it. And Harrow asks, what will you finish? And she says, it doesn't matter. But I imagine what it is killing God and destroying the Nine Houses and wiping out necromancy. And honestly, like quite a bucket list. But Harrow, I think, considers it for a second, but everyone is like, no. And the sleeper approaches Harrow. She's counting down. And right when it seems like she's about to shoot Harrow in the head, Ordis clears his throat, which we know to signify that he's about to quote his poetry. But we move into chapter 48, which takes us back out of the bubble.
So hold on to your hats, everyone, because we'll be back to see what the hell Ordis is going to say after these next few messages. Guess who's back, 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 back again, again. Shades. The shades are back. Tell a friend.
So many jokes today.
We are in chapter 48. There is a third house skull. We are in the first and second person, which means that we are back with Gideon and Harrow's body. And basically what happens in this chapter is that Gideon runs into Ianthe. There's a lot of insults thrown back and forth, which is really fun. This is like some of the best dialogue, I don't know, in the book.
I know, it's so good.
And then with all those insults thrown back and forth, there's a lot of really heart-wrenching shit just woven throughout this chapter. So it's a real roller coaster.
Yeah, this is really, really, really primo Tamsin Muir. Rip your heart out with a joke on the side.
I think if I were to give anyone an excerpt to be like, here's the vibe of the book, I would probably give them chapter 48.
Without them having read any books? Mel, you would ruin it completely.
No, they wouldn't know what they were reading.
All right, fair.
Anyway, Gideon is back and she wades through a bunch of heralds or whatever. She finds Ianthe standing on a table screaming or being a lictor who fights heralds.
Yes.
And Ianthe is like, Harry, you're... And Gideon says, alive, bitch, which is, oh my God, what I would give to enter a room and just announce myself like that.
You're welcome to announce yourself like that anytime you walk into a room with me in there.
Thanks. I plan to, yeah, for sure. But basically, Gideon's all mad because Ianthe's been messing with Harrow. Mm-hmm. According to Gideon, I love this validating quote here where Gideon, talking to Harrow through the narration, mm-hmm, says, when I saw that tall, hot glass of skank and heard her diffident, oh, you, like she'd never fake to your fucking face, like she couldn't see a corpse that was obviously there.
Yeah.
I love that line because we had so many questions. And, you know, who knows? But if we are meant to really trust our two core characters here, this just validates for us that Kitherea was definitely under the bed.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a receipt in that direction, for sure. Gideon was seen through Harrow's eyes, so she would have seen it, of course.
Yeah.
But still, I feel like, I think that this is a pretty good indication. I don't know. We don't know. But I think that probably it was there, and Ianthe was being a huge dick.
Yeah, and someday we'll find out, mm-hmm, why. And then the other thing that I love about this chapter is, so Gideon says to Ianthe, I'm going to pull your whole ass off. Do you want that? Do you want Harrow to grow you a new bone ass where I pull off the old one? Y'all, there are so many butt jokes in this chapter, and I didn't really notice all the ass jokes, uh-huh, until I fucking read Nona, the first six chapters, where they're tallying ass jokes to see if Nona is Gideon.
That's a great callback. I didn't notice that at all.
It's so funny. They're like, Pal, Cam, and Pyrrha are trying to figure out who Nona is. Is it Harrow? Can she play with the bones? Or is it Gideon? Does she make ass jokes? Mm-hmm. And so ever since I read that, when we've been rereading Harrow, I've been noticing all these hilarious ass jokes that Gideon makes. It's so good.
Yeah. I will never miss them again, now that you've brought this to my attention. So Gideon asks if they killed the resurrection beast, and Ianthe says, no, Mercy disappeared, then Harrow disappeared, and then Augustine disappeared, and so she left.
Not Harrow. Harrow didn't disappear. Harrow wasn't fighting the beast, was she?
Well, it says that.
Does it say that?
It says, Mercy disappeared, we didn't expect that, then Harrow disappeared, we did expect that.
Oh, you're right.
That.
Yeah. Weird.
So okay. What I assume happened is that, I guess maybe Harrow did start fighting the beast, but regardless, Mercy disappeared, I guess, to go kill Harrow, and then Harrow would have disappeared when Mercy stabbed her.
Right. You're right, because the book starts out with Harrow closing her eyes along with all the other lictors, and then Hell spit her back out, right, once she was stabbed.
Right. So I'm not entirely sure why Mercy – we still don't know why Mercy – disappeared in this very pivotal fight to go kill Harrow. Just, yeah, seems like a really weird choice. But she did, and then Augustine disappeared, presumably to go look for her.
Yeah, something's up. Something is up.
It's very weird that they all left and just left Gideon there. Gideon the, yeah, first there to fight the resurrection beast on his own.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's funny because when Ianthe says this, Gideon's like, oh, if you're talking about the sour face donkey's ass, hello, another ass joke, with the net, Ianthe's very quickly like, oh, yes, that's Mercy.
Which I know.
I just think is so good. But Ianthe seems genuinely confused as to why Mercy would kill Harrow.
Right.
I feel like sometimes in these books, I felt like this very much in Gideon the First, where because we didn't see from Harrow's perspective, I kind of assumed Harrow knew everything. Uh-huh. And then as soon as you read from Harrow's perspective, you realize what she did and didn't know.
Right.
And I think similarly, we know Ianthe is up to no good, but we also know there's a lot of other characters up to no good. And Ianthe's definitely not privy to the plans of everyone else. And that's pretty clear right here.
So Ianthe says that they should head out because she has something to give to Gideon, and they leave the kitchen, right, where Ianthe was fighting.
Yeah. And who does Gideon encounter but our beloved Augustine.
Is he beloved, though?
All these characters are beloved to me. I hate a lot of them, but I also love them. Anyway, Gideon encounters Augustine, and just like Ianthe, Augustine at first thinks that Gideon is Hero until he sees Gideon's eyes.
Right.
And he's like, John, joy, and then runs away. Mm-hmm. And so we know that Augustine thinks, similar to Gideon's encounter with Mercy, that Gideon is Electo because of Gideon's golden eyes. And Gideon says she's never seen anyone look at anything the way that Augustine and Mercy looked at their eyes. Mm-hmm. And this all happens right in front of Ianthe. Mm-hmm. And Ianthe's just like, whoa, mystery on mystery.
Yeah.
And then there's another butt joke, but I won't say what it is because I actually don't really like it that much.
Is it the punch the butthole?
Yeah, I really don't like
that. Why don't you like it?
Ooh. No, it, like, pains me.
I like the part where she says, quite apart from your hurtful threats of sexual violence.
I know, that's why I don't like it. It's so, ugh. She says, why your fist is so big and my butthole is so small.
Oh my god. Oy. It's so funny though.
It is. It's also, Gideon is really funny with the insults and Ianthe's really clever with her insults. Mm-hmm. And so this is just like, it's just fun.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
They are a really good pair for the comedy.
Yeah, totally. And hey, Amy, guess what makes another appearance here? The melon.
Oh my god, right, the melon.
Makes another appearance.
How could I have forgotten?
So Gideon enters Ianthe's chambers and says, I was almost too stressed and distracted to appreciate that awe-inspiring painting of the banging cavalier holding a melon. Y'all, the melon has now been mentioned again many chapters later. I think this is going to be important.
I really want more fan art of the melon.
Yeah, y'all. Can you get on that?
I bet there is actually a lot of melon fan art.
I'm sure. Yeah. I just need to do a little digging.
Right. So Ianthe then gives Gideon a letter which says on the envelope to be given to Gideon Nav.
Yeah. And this is a hard part to read. Mm-hmm. I think Gideon says, this is a letter that you touched, and you must know it was destroying me to be there in your body, and I can't even hear your voice. It's like, Hero's body's here, but Hero's not here. Gideon's in her body, she's just feeling all sorts of ways. And she goes to open that letter, and just when you think your heart couldn't break anymore, she opens it up, and the sunglasses are there. And Gideon puts them on. And Amy, what does the letter say?
It says, one flesh, one end.
Which is very unsatisfying. It was very unsatisfying for me, and it's very unsatisfying for Gideon.
Yeah, Gideon's pretty pissed.
Gideon's like, dude, I already gave my flesh to you. I already gave my end to you. I gave you my sword. I gave you myself. I did it while knowing I'd do it all again without hesitation because all I ever wanted you to do was eat me.
That's right. I'm not even going to comment on that.
One receipt in one direction. That is so shockingly blatant. I feel like Tamsin Muir gets bolder and bolder towards the end of these books.
Yeah. It's true.
You gotta love a little eat me innuendo. So basically, after Gideon opens this letter, she and Ianthe get into like a verbal battle about who Hero loves, essentially. And Ianthe tries to hit Gideon where it hurts, which basically says, like, if you love someone, you're gonna keep every little thing about them. I've loved plenty, okay? And so I know this, which, sidebar, who has Ianthe loved plenty? I want to know.
I think it's Corona Beth.
You think they have a weird twin thing?
No, I think that this isn't talking about, I mean, we talked a lot about different kinds of love. I think Ianthe does truly love Corona Beth.
Mm.
it's not healthy. It's not like a healthy love per se, but I think that that's what she's referring to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I kind of want a short story with Ianthe's other lovers because I'm just so curious what they would even be like.
Also, there's that bit where Ianthe says that she and Coronabeth only slept apart like twice in their entire lives. So anyway, we won't go too deep into that. Let's move on.
So Ianthe's trying to hit Gideon where it hurts, which is actually the opposite of what Ianthe feels, because communicated in the Epiperidos, in reflecting on what Harrow's done to her brain, she calls it a destructive, romantic, ridiculous act. And so Ianthe does recognize what Harrow did as love. It's just expressed in a different way, and Harrow's coping with grief in a different way. It's not because she doesn't love Gideon, and Ianthe very much knows that, but is really trying to take Gideon down here.
Yeah.
And then Gideon basically explodes into this kind of defensiveness where she says, you think you can make me jealous? You think anything I did has been to make her love me? And essentially tells Ianthe that Harrow opened the locked tomb and has been in love with the body in the locked tomb since she saw it.
Right.
Gideon shares this really sad line that says, the moment she told me about the body, you should have seen her face, the look on her face. I never made her look like that. She can't love me even if I'd wanted her to. She can't love you. She can't even try.
This is very anti-Polly, I feel like.
Yeah, totally.
Why is Gideon so sure?
You know, Gideon's been through a lot, so this is true. She's just defaulting back into like maybe old patterns. Maybe Gideon wants to be monogamous. These books are very poly, and this is very much the opposite of that, totally. But then there's this interesting back and forth between Ianthe and Gideon, and I didn't think anything of it until I was preparing for this episode. But after Gideon tells Ianthe that Harrow opened the locked tomb, she's in love with this dead body, Ianthe says, oh, please, as though... And then Gideon cuts her off with these, like, really great zingers. It's like, you have nonagesimitis, and I know you want the vitamin H.
Yes.
And then Ianthe says, really? A corpse? And says this with not totally believable carelessness. Gideon, of course, injects, she wants the D, and the D stands for dead.
Oh, my God.
And in reading this the first time through, I'm like, oh, Ianthe's just, like, really blindsided by the fact that Harrow's in love with a dead body. But when I was rereading this, I realized the big reveal here is that Gideon just told Ianthe that the locked tomb has been open, which is a really big deal. And if you actually were to finish Ianthe's sentences here, where she says, oh, please, as though Harrow opened the locked tomb. Really, a corpse is in the locked tomb? I don't know. I think because Gideon's cutting her off, and sometimes, yes, Gideon is really perceptive, but she also interrupts and can be like really one-track mind. And I kind of wonder if Ianthe's now like calculating and is like, oh shit, the locked tomb is open. How am I going to spin this to my advantage?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think it's kind of a little bit of both. I think she is sort of taken aback by this new knowledge specifically about Harrow and Harrow's preferences. But yeah, of course she must be adding this to her list of information that I'm sure that she's trying to use in any way she can to give herself an advantage.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's a really good read.
We'll see. And then I had one more thought about this back and forth, or really question, and it's really about a joke that I think I'm missing, and I don't really get it. But Gideon is, like, making a jack-off motion while Ianthe's talking, and Ianthe's like, don't do that, or I will show you Harrow's kidneys. And Gideon then goes off and is like, don't touch her, don't do anything. Don't do any of the shit necromancers lie and say they don't do the moment two of them get nasty. And Ianthe says, what can I say? I love a little gall on gall. And then Gideon says, reverse everything I told you. Let's get married. What is happening here?
Well, it's a joke, gall, like gallbladder. But she's saying gal on gal, like gal on gal, like girl on girl. And you know Gideon loves a good pun. So Gideon's like, JK, let's get married. I love that pun. I think that's what's happening.
I see. Okay. It's nothing deeper than that.
No, I don't think it's very deep at all. I think it's just a good pun.
All right. Sweet. Well, you know I love a good pun.
I know this very well.
So then this chapter really closes with Ianthe saying, yo, we got to go to God. He's got to figure out how to fix you. Mm-hmm. And Gideon's like, I don't want to. And then realizes that the resurrection beast is coming. Like, Gideon doesn't want Hero to die. So feels that the only choice here is to go to God and see if he can help them out.
Right. And I really like the last line of this chapter. It is, I still didn't know if you were going to kick my ass for that conversation or if you would be sorry for me. I knew which one would be worse. That's so sad.
It's so sad. Womp womp.
Yeah. I mean, we have this debate about Gideon and Hero and their relationship, and I don't necessarily think it's going to end with them like walking off into the sunset holding hands. But I mean, Gideon definitely has some very like complicated queer mixed up feelings about Hera that I don't even think that she understands, but they're romantic if nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, I think if Hera was like, Gideon, let's do it, I think Gideon would be like, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like she'd say that to almost everyone though.
That's, yeah, fair. Okay.
So we pick back up in chapter 49 with the second half of this epic, freaking, incredible boss battle. It's like the most epic and satisfying boss battle ever written anywhere.
Wow!
Mel, there's something that happens to me in this chapter, and I feel like I might actually need you to take over at parts because I cry quite hard.
Oh my God. I don't know if I can do it justice. If I have to take over, I think you should really take the lead on this one since you're so passionate. Come on, sell me on it. Tell me why this is your favorite chapter.
Well, first of all, just for tradition's sake, we have a fractured ninth house skull. We are in the third person river bubble, and Ordis Nigenat has just cleared his throat and he starts quoting the Noniad. You know why I love this chapter? It is the perfect distillation of everyone's personality, and it ties up so many strings so neatly. It's very neat, but also like very emotional, and I love it.
You know, are you the kind of person who gets teary-eyed at like large group camaraderie? You know, like when I say that, I mean like, have you watched V for Vendetta?
Yeah.
And like the moment where at the end of the movie where, spoiler, where everyone shows up with their mask on the date.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I sob every time. It's hilarious. It's like that kind of, wow, everyone's showing up for each other and there's teamwork and camaraderie. That definitely gets me.
If your thing is the Marvel Universe, it's like the last movie, I forget what it's called. I'm not a very good nerd when it comes to Marvel, but when everyone shows up at the final battle and it's like the crew has assembled. It's that feeling. All of these things come together so nicely, and it really ties off this part of the book so well. And I'm just so satisfied. Also, there's this, well, let's go through it bit by bit. So meanwhile, Ordis is starting to quote the Noniad. Hera was trying to raise this bone wall, similar to the one she raised at the end of Gideon, but the sleeper is able to just sort of shoulder through it. The sleeper shoots Ordis. Ordis pauses in his recitation, and Hera continues where Ordis left off. She also notices that Abigail is chanting in the background, and Ordis and Hera together are quoting this part of the Noniad. It's very cute for Hera to like show
right, up. Right, right. This is cute. This is cute. I'll give you that. I think it's just really corny. I think that's like, which is the point.
I love corny. I mean, one of my favorite movies is Rudy.
Yeah, okay. Wow.
I feel like I might have to cut that.
No, put it all out there.
Oh, geez. Okay. But when the sleeper is about to shoot Harrow and it's its last moment, instead of the gun going off, all of the flames in the room sort of erupt in this black flame. I can visualize this so well, and it's just so cool in my head. And the next bit of description is just incredible. Abigail is standing holding this ethereal book, which I assume is the Noniad, and she looks very, it says, feral. And the quote is, "The House of the Fifth always skinned itself over with such airs of civilization, with so many manners and niceties, but they were spirit talkers and speakers to the dead, and the dead were savage." And it's just so good.
Yeah, it's fucking good.
Abigail is a good girl, but also like super freaking smart and a badass. And I love that that comes through here. And then, you know what's funny is now I'm reading this and I'm like, this is so corny, but it's so good.
But I think it's meant to be corny.
Yeah.
You were so bought in. Now I'm going back. I don't love this chapter, but I'm like really getting into it because you're so passionate about it. But like, you know, you get to this point, there's been so much going on. We're exhausted.
Yeah.
We have gone through a roller coaster of emotions and we just want a fucking win. My favorite character comes back and it's Gideon, right? But there's no Harrow. And you're right. Like, God damn it, we can't have it all. And then finally in this chapter, we get a win and it's really cool and it feels good.
Yeah. In the moment between Wake shooting at Harrow and Matthias Nonius appearing, there's this really cool image of, it says that time basically slows down. So you have to imagine time is stopped. All of the shadows in the room gather as this one shadow standing between Harrow and the sleeper. Abigail's off looking like a fucking sick ass blue candle witch in the corner. Hot as hell. And all of a sudden, there's the bling, 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 bling of the ninth house bells filling the chamber. I mean, I'm tearing up.
Yeah. And I think the best part of this is that the person who appears is Matthias Nonius. Because he's kind of been a joke throughout these books about how obsessed Ordis is with Matthias Nonius. Yeah. And you're like, who could possibly appear here? And then it's Matthias Nonius. And you're like, oh my God, this guy again? And it's really funny. And it's epic because Matthias Nonius is a major hero.
Right.
But also hilarious.
You know, it was always a joke, but she was also building up this anticipation about this character. And all of a sudden, this character is here.
You never see it coming.
Mm-mm. You never thought you would see this ancient. You thought it was a joke. And yeah. But here he is. I also think it's interesting because what makes him a little bit less corny and more believable in this bit is that he's a very simple looking dude. She actually based Matthias Nonius, or at least named him after Matthias of Redwall.
Mm.
I don't know if you read those books when you were a kid.
I know what they are, but I didn't read them. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You really should read them literally just for the food descriptions. But
ooh, okay.
Matthias of Redwall, he's a mouse and he's very simple and he doesn't seem very impressive or scary, but he's the greatest warrior of this abbey, basically.
Mm.
Throughout all of these books, one of the books is actually about him, but through all of these books, he's kind of this legend. And so they share a lot of similarities because it turns out that Matthias Nonius is also very plain. So I've really worked myself up. Okay, one more thing is that Matthias Nonius throughout this entire chapter speaks only in meter.
So I need someone to explain this to me. What is meter?
So you know when we were talking about how there was that bit where Harrow and Ordis were arguing over the way he was writing his poetry?
Yeah.
Meter is the rhythm in which you write poetry.
Got it. So he's basically speaking the way Ordis has written the Noniad.
Exactly. Everything Matthias Nonius says in this bit is said in enneameter, which is a verse with 9 feet. So that's really funny and pretty impressive, honestly, that it's done that way.
I wonder how long it took for Tamsin Muir to craft that, or if she's just like, boom, 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 bang it out.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll have to ask her.
Tamsin Muir, if you're listening, please write in.
So we won't go over the entire fight, but the line that really kills me, I don't know what it is about it, but when Matthias Nonius appears in front of Harrow and stops the bullet with, I think, his rapier.
With his rapier.
Frickin' Jedi style.
Yeah.
He says, ninth was my name and ninth was my hearth and my homeland. And there's something about that bit that I just like get weepy every time. I love a big anthemic type of ending where everything comes together. And I just think it's really good.
I mean, we don't get that in real life. So it's really nice to have it in books.
That's why I read speculative fiction.
Yeah. I'm like, make it better.
Yeah. I want a victorious moment like this that you can't really have in real life.
Yeah. And I think the other thing here that makes this so meaningful is like, Hera's been fighting her whole life to keep her house alive and has really felt alone and is extremely passionate about the ninth house, is maybe like the most passionate about the ninth house of anyone who exists today.
Right.
And so to have this man come back with as much or more passion for her home, I mean, God, I don't know.
It's just really, really cool. The fight between Matthias Nonius and the Sleeper is really well written. The Sleeper is basically wailing on him, and he's just very still and just taking little shots when he can get them. But slowly, as the fight progresses, the Sleeper starts to take the lead, basically. But also, while this is happening, Harrow's looking around, and she sees that the room is turning into a room in the ninth house, and that the Sleeper's clothing and mask is changing into this sort of fencing suit, I think, and this interesting gold mask of a face. And basically what it's becoming is one of Ordis's poems. So there's this push and pull between Wake's creepy freaking flesh web reality and
flesh web. Let's just flesh web. More.
That's a direct quote. And Ordis Nigenad's epic poem. So this progresses. And what's really interesting, and I have to say, I do love this chapter. What I love about it is not necessarily the fight, even though I think it's incredibly well written. It's everything before the fight and everything after the fight that really just gets me.
I think what's cool about the room turning is obviously Wake is this incredibly intense person that has had so much willpower, like we just talked about this.
Right.
But Matthias's passion for the ninth house is enough to yank Harrow's soul back away from Wake. And it's funny because it's so simple. It's not this complex necromancy. I'm sure there's a very detailed magic system behind this, whatever. Right. But it's literally, who's more passionate? Who has more willpower?
Right.
It's not even about like how good of fighters they are. That's not what ultimately wins this battle. It's whose passion is going to be enough to keep hold of Harrow's soul.
Right. I also think it's interesting that this makes it very believable that Gideon is so good at what she does.
Right, totally.
Not that we really needed an explanation, but it's like, oh, yeah, genetically, she is set up to be fucking intense and really good at sports.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess she maybe got her sense of humor from Jod, but yeah, her fighting, man, obviously that came from her mama.
Yeah, got it from her mama. Another interesting thing that happens at the end of the fight is that the Sleeper does end up disarming Matthias Nonius, and you think in this moment all is lost. But actually what that does is it says it snaps some invisible shackle. And Matthias Nonius, as much as he's able to work within these parameters, he was kind of held back by the confines of this reality refracted through Ordis Nigenad's poem. And once he loses his rapier, he's free to just kind of let loose. And he goes at the Sleeper. And basically just with his knife, and his body is able to take her out. And then at the end, Protesilaus throws him the seventh house rapier, and he stabs her through the heart, I believe, and he wins. Clap, clap.
Clap, clap. Also, during this fight, there are really funny moments where Wake starts to talk in meter.
Yes.
Which is hilarious. And then also, Protesilaus and Ordis on the side are becoming not hostile towards each other anymore. They're kind of like so equally impressed with Matthias Nonius. Dulcinea maybe goes to try and see if she can like help out. And they essentially pull her back and they're like, no, no, he fights alone.
Yeah, they're such dorks.
And it's just these like men being so dorky.
So funny.
It's really good.
We learn a little bit more about Wake. She says, my master in life was revenge, something like that. And I think what she means is revenge on God for basically his creation of necromancy and wiping out Earth and whatever. So they end up winning the battle. They have the sleeper on the floor and they're able to take her mask off. And Hera recognizes her as the woman whose portrait was in the shuttle with Judith and with Coronabeth on the planet where she met Camilla. And it's interesting because this implies that she doesn't actually recognize Gideon in the face, that she doesn't see the resemblance.
Right. Totally. Which is interesting because I think we were thinking that maybe Hera was putting it all together, but I'm not so sure. I mean, would you be able to put this together if you just had Hera's perspective? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Like, red hair? I don't think it's a very common color. Anyway. In the nine houses?
There's only two people in all the nine houses that have red hair.
Well, isn't there a bit where someone's like, where did you get your hair color? Maybe you're from the third house. It sounds like it's rare.
Yeah. Well, Harrow can't put everything together.
It's true. Ordis immediately flirts with Abigail, saying that he's going to write the Pentiad.
Oh my God. I love that.
He has such a crush on Abigail. So Pent explains that what happened is that she was basically able to call this ghost back through sheer passion, which I guess she didn't think was possible. But also, just to go back to Wake, the other identifying factor on the sleeper is a dog tag, I think, that says Awake. And we later learn that that's part of her name. So they're all kind of catching up after the battle. And Matthias says that if he's done here, he wants to go help fight a dread beast in the river. And it turns out that he did actually, at one point, fight Gideon the First, which is a fight that Ordis and Harrow have had for forever.
About whether that was actually true.
Right. And so he decides to go and help Gideon, and then Ordis decides to go with him, and then Protesilaus.
I find that all so funny.
I know.
These three men are just praising each other left and right in these grand statements. Oh my God, it's so funny. And then they all get together and they're like, let's go be heroes even more.
Kappa Sig. But then freaking Marta joins. I mean, who?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who is a frat boy if not Marta?
Yeah.
Because she says that the reason that she wants to go is because chicken shits don't get beer.
Which Matthias Nonius is familiar with, that phrase, which is also very funny.
It all comes together. It really gets me, Mel.
Yeah, no, it's very cute. I had one thing, though, that I wanted to throw in here.
Yeah.
Which is when they're all kind of like jacking each other off.
Oh.
Matthias Nonius is like, my bones fell far from home. Never, I think, will a wanderer happen upon where they now lie, far though he travel.
Yes.
I'm just saying, I think that's going to come back. I don't know why.
Hmm.
But I think it's this really random thing to just throw in here for no reason.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I don't know. I mean, who even knows? I wonder if we'll have another moment at the very end of Alecto where it's another, like, everyone gathers for the final battle and they all show up in the river and... You know, Matthias, I don't know.
I mean,
know.
We can only hope. We can only hope.
And then it ends with Harrow being like, all right, Gideon, I guess we better jet off. We got a lot of work to do to continue to fix the world. And it's implied that maybe they'll get together, but it's never actually, you know what I mean? I feel like that's...
And then 20 years later, we'll get a fifth book out of nowhere.
For all the fans.
It's kind of like how Sense8 put out their second season for the fans. Did you watch that?
No, but I know that you do love it.
Oh my God, Amy, are you, of all the people who should watch Sense8, you have to.
I have a really hard time with television.
No. It's the gayest thing in the world. You have to, I can't even believe this. I will watch She-Ra if you watch Sense8.
Okay, this is a good trade. All right, you guys heard it first. Mel's going to watch my favorite show, She-Ra and the Princesses of Power. And I am going to watch Sense8. We'll get back to you. Maybe that'll be our next podcast.
Oh, yeah.
A side-by-side comparison of Sense8 and She-Ra. Okay, so at the very end of this section, Abigail sends Matthias, Ordis, Protesilaus, and Marta into the river, and then she explains to Harrow the only real option is for her to go back to her body. Otherwise, she'll just go crazy as a ghost in the river. And Harrow's really pushing back against this. And then Magnus has this very, very, heartbreaking monologue that is another reason I love this chapter. Because this whole time, Harrow kind of, I think she likes Magnus, but doesn't think like super well of him.
Harrow definitely doesn't think that much of Magnus. Right before all the boys plus Marta go off to fight with Gideon, They all look to Harrow as though on fatal cue, legends, soldiers, poets, Magnus.
That's so funny. But it is nice that in this last moment that Harrow has with Magnus, he's the one that really convinces her that she needs to let Gideon go and go live for Gideon. He says, "You're a smart girl, Harrow Hark. You might turn some of that brain to the toughest lesson, that of grief." Ugh. Mm. And with this, she kind of starts to decide that she is going to go back into her body. And she tells Magnus and Abigail that she's planning to go back and that they can leave knowing that everything's going to be okay. And Abigail says goodbye. Magnus says goodbye. And they're gone. And the only person left, weirdly, is Dulcinea Septimus. And Harrow's like, what are you doing? You need to go. You're going to get crushed by this bubble building. And Dulcinea says, I'm actually going to risk staying here because I want to tell you something. And that's where the chapter ends.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
So many cliffhangers. I feel like every chapter in these three chapters, all three end with a really good cliffhanger.
It's true. And it's not like we really needed any more motivation to completely gobble this up every single time. But I mean, I appreciate the extra effort, I guess. So that's what we're covering today. We have one more episode of Harrow left. And we're going to try and get that out next weekend, right before Nona the Ninth comes out.
Oh my God.
And then we will be reading along with you guys. Thank you so much for coming with us on this journey.
Yeah. We did want to mention that we know a lot of you have written in to us and know that we have read every single message that has come in. We have been so stressed. And between our day jobs, you know, what we do to make a little bit of money, and doing this podcast, we have been totally swamped. And just want to say we really appreciate everyone who's written in. I actually did want to mention one person who wrote in, and that is the person that validated me when I said that the PPPPS situation was read by Moira Quirk in Corona Beth's voice. You really validated me. Amy still disagrees. Amy thinks Moira Quirk maybe made a mistake. I say Moira Quirk doesn't make a mistake. I know that Harrow and Ianthe talk about this moment, but they don't not say that Corona Beth wasn't there. So I don't know. I'm just saying.
I think that there's almost nothing you could ever do to convince me, but But I will say that I think that you have a really good read on these books, and you've definitely opened my eyes to many things. And if it happens that you are right, then I will very happily paint my body as a skeleton and parade around the streets. So,
oh my God. Oh, wow. Anyway, point is, thank y'all for writing in. We're hoping to do some more smaller episodes once Nona is out so that we can talk through all the things y'all have written in and be a little more interactive. But right now, we are on a deadline.
Yeah, but it's so sweet. We're having so much fun. You guys are the best. We really appreciate the love, and it is not going into a void when you write us something. We're going to get to them as soon as we can. So we love you, and we hope you liked listening. Please do rate and review us. That's honestly the thing that helps us most to get new listeners, which is cool. No, it is cool.
Here you go.
It's very going cool. I don't know what else. I mean, it's cool.
It is really cool.
It's cool. When we see that people are listening to this podcast, we're like, damn, that's cool. Okay. If you have questions or comments or want to point something out that we missed, send us a question on our website, lockedtombpod.com, or on Twitter at lockedtombpod. We release episodes on a day of the week, sometimes Tuesdays, wherever you find podcasts. Thanks as always to Olivia Kay for our theme music. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
And we'll see you next time here at the Locked Tomb Podcast.